This is a production of Cornell University.
Lots of announcements before we begin tonight. The next reading in our series, and this is 5 of 6 this fall, will be Lee Smith and Hal Crowther reading together 2 weeks from tonight, November 15th, in this room, also at 7:30 or 7:33. There will be a reception following this reading. And by the way, the reading will be followed by questions and answers. So after the whole event, there's a reception to which all of you are invited. And if you have reason to believe that you look younger than 21, please bring your photo ID. You may buy books after the reading right here. And I feel like a flight attendant right here. But we ask you to take the reading, the books upstairs after the reading to have them signed. Finally, I want to mention that John Lennon, J. Robert Lennon, has interviewed William Kennedy, our guest of honor tonight, and will be putting the interview on the web on the English Department site as a podcast, along with some other interviews that John has put there. Is that right, John?
Yeah, it's on there now.
It's on there now. It's on there now, so you can go straight home. And if you're carded with unfortunate circumstances, you can go straight home and listen to the podcast. Well, all good writers seem to be good oral storytellers. They're the kind of people whom you'd like to spend an evening with over a beer or a cup of coffee, or, because this is Cornell, a cup of herbal tea. Or maybe I should say tofu and herbal tea. And all good storytellers tend to be good teachers, because teaching is really a long conversation, often conducted at a big table. And certainly in the writing courses at Cornell, it's a long conversation at a big table. Good teachers are sometimes rewarded by the gratitude of their students, and maybe often in the case of the one of our other guests of honor tonight. And it is the gratitude of a particular student who has brought us together tonight for the 5th James McConkie reading in American fiction. Now, this reading is to honor Jim McConkie, who is here tonight, who is an extraordinary writer who has been publishing books since 1957, and I can't do the arithmetic, but I think that's decades. Most recently in 2004. Essays, novels, short stories, memoirs, they're tender, thoughtful, and finally tough at the core, immensely readable, and available at your local bookstores. And do we have Jim's books here tonight as well? But in any case, they're all over town and, of course, on the web. The student who has brought us here together and who founded the James McConkie Readings in American Fiction is Fred Parkin, who graduated in 1963 from Cornell and comes back here often. And we've had really an extraordinary series. It's our first fiction series, and it's our continuing fiction series that Fred Parkin has funded. And with great generosity, we've had Tim O'Brien, Tobias Wolfe, Jamaica Kincaid, Dennis Johnson, and tonight, William Kennedy. I wonder if both of these men would stand up and allow us to honor them with our applause. Jim McConkie and Fred Parkin. There are a lot of very good writers, very good storytellers, and very good teachers in the room tonight, and I welcome all of you. One of them will be introducing William Kennedy, and that is Lamar Herron, who is amazingly an emeritus professor. That word still doesn't seem to fit Lamar. He published 2 books in the year 2006, which I think I can do that arithmetic. Last year, he published two books, which is the year he retired, and one of them called Romancing Spain, the other House of the Deaf. Am I getting this right, Lamar? And they're both in different ways and in extraordinarily different ways about love, although there are many about many other things as well. Please join me in welcoming Lamar Herron, who will introduce William Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Fred and Jim, for another wonderful occasion. I'm a little surprised that Bill Kennedy agreed to come read here tonight. The first time he was invited was, I believe, in 1978, and he and his wife, Dana, braved a snowstorm to drive all the way from Albany to read before an audience of nine. In the old Temple of Zeus, because the students couldn't be bothered to walk up Live Slope. He read from Billy Phelan's Greatest Game and showed some of us a manuscript then called Lemonweed. In 1982-83, he returned as a guest teacher for a year, and perhaps Cornell brought him some much-deserved luck, for that was the year that Lemonweed, now entitled Ironweed, found a publisher and won Bill a ton of prizes, including the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer, and it was all topped off with a MacArthur Award. So maybe Cornell redeemed itself and we're back to even. A string of wonderful novels followed, Quinn's book, The Flaming Corsage, Very Old Bones, and Roscoe, plus a history slash celebration of the home turf for it all, O Albany. And I would like to believe that that year at Cornell gave Bill some very big mo that is yet to run out, and for his next novel has taken him and Albany all the way down to the Caribbean. But he's here tonight to read for us on All Saints Day. Before Ironweed even appeared, Epoch magazine, with its uncanny eye for genius, had published two chapters from that novel, one of which has Francis Phelan visiting the family cemetery. I wondered if that could have taken place on All Saints Day and decided to reread the chapter in question. Only Ironweed was missing from my bookshelf. And any teacher of creative writing will know why. Your best books frequently go missing, since those are the ones you tell students they simply must read. And then you become so insistent you take it off your bookshelf and place it in their hands. Some are returned, but most of your favorites are not. So I don't know if Francis Phelan visited the cemetery on All Saints Day, the day when the saved souls in heaven are remembered and revered, even those of some notorious sinners while down here on earth, Phelan's, for instance, or Quinn's or McElhinney's. For Bill writes of larger than life sinners whom he redeems. Such is the power of great art and the great artists who produce it. His town, his territory, is Albany, New York, as Faulkner's was Yoknapatawpha County and Garcia Marcus is Macondo. You frequently hear Bill Kennedy's name and achievement mentioned in the company of those two giants, and the comparison is entirely deserved. But as any writer and any reader enamored of good writing knows, you finally go to the books for the sentence and the word. Here, from the very great and wonderfully named Very Old Bones, are two sentences. Why would Lizzie McElhinney, a plain beauty of divine form and pale brown hair to the middle of her back, choose to dance with a tree, or a shadow, or a man, if man it ever was or could be, at the edge of a meadow, just as a summer night began its starry course? Age 26, married 5 years to Malachy McElhinney, a man of formidable girth whose chief skill was his strength, a man of ill luck and no prospects, Lizzie, nay, Elizabeth Cronin, had within her the spirit of a sensuous bird. And here's another sentence. The money, and this is the money that Lizzie herself made making birds and selling them, cloth birds, the money so excited Lizzie that when crossing the meadow on her way home from the store, she kicked off her shoes, threw herself into the air and into the wind, danced until breath left her, and then collapsed into the tall grass at the edge of the sycamore grove, a breathless victim of jubilation. The tenderness and the authorial weight behind that last phrase, a breathless victim of jubilation, are vintage Bill Kennedy. To make up for that blizzardy night back in 1978 when only 9 of you showed up, would you please give him your warmest welcome?
You don't get introductions like that every day. I remember that night very well, and it was one of the worst nights of weather in the history of weather. And tractor trailers were off into the middle of the grass alongside the highway. There was no way to know where the road began or ended. I don't know how we really got here. It was a blizzard. And the snow, I don't blame the students for not coming up the hill. The snow was like up to here. It was unbelievable. And but I cherish those 9 people who were here. I remember among them were Edward Hauer and Allison Laurie, in addition to Lamar and Amparo, and I believe Walter Slatoff was here, and maybe Tony Caputi. And I'm not sure who else, but I bless them in memory. And the visit was, that it made everybody on the campus so guilty that they did invite me back. And after I came back and read downtown to many more than 9, I was invited to come back and teach here. And I did that in 1982-83. I taught a fiction writing class to juniors and seniors and a creative writing class to freshmen and sophomores, I guess. I don't know who they were, including teaching poetry. And I can't believe that I really braved that semester teaching poetry. But I have not done it since, and I dare not do it again. And I pledge never to do it again. Anyway, I'm going to read tonight from a book I just published my most recent novel called Roscoe. And then I'll read from a work in progress, which I didn't think I'd do, but I'm so happy to be back at Cornell that I don't give a damn. So anyway, here's Roscoe. It's a political novel, set in Albany, of all places. That year, an ill wind blew over the city and threatened to destroy flower pots, family fortunes, reputations, true love, and several types of virtue. Roscoe, moving along the road, felt the wind at his back and heard the wind-blown voices. "Do you know where the ill wind comes from, Roscoe?" the voices asked him. "No," he said, "but I'm not sure the wind is really ill. Its illness may be overrated, maybe even fraudulent." "Do people think there's such a thing as a good ill wind?" they asked. "Of course," he answered, "and when it comes, it billows the sails of our city. It nourishes our babies, comforts our aliens, gives purpose to our dead, tranquilizes our useless, straightens our crooked, and vice versa. And the ill wind is a nonsuch and demands close attention. Why should we believe what you say?" "As I'm incapable of truth," Roscoe said, "so I'm incapable of lying, which is, as all know, the secret of the truly successful politician." "Are you a politician, Roscoe?" "I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might degrade or incriminate me." Is there any water by? Yes, there is. Oh, great. Thank you. Whoever put it there. Thank you. Roscoe Owen Conway presided at Albany Democratic Party headquarters on the 11th floor of the State Bank Building, the main stop for the Democrats on the way to heaven. Headquarters occupied three large offices where Roscoe, secretary and second in command of the party, received supplicants and debtors, one where Bart Merrigan and Joey Minucci controlled the flow of visitors and phone calls, and one for the safe, which when put here was the largest in the city outside of a bank vault. Of late, no money was kept in it, only deceptive Democratic financial data to feed the governor's investigators who had been swooping down on the party's files since 1942, the year the governor-elect vowed to destroy Albany Democrats. Money, instead of going into the great safe, went into Roscoe's top drawer where he would put it without counting it when a visitor such as Philly Philippone, who sold produce to the city and county, handed him a packet of cash an inch thick, held by a rubber band. "Maybe you better count it, make sure there's no mistake," Philly said. Roscoe did not acknowledge that Philly had raised the possibility of shorting the party even by accident. He dropped the cash into the open drawer where Philly could see a pile of 20s. Democratic business was done with 20s. Then Philly asked, "Any change in how we work this year, Roscoe?" "No," said Roscoe, "same as usual." And Philly went away. At his desk by the door, Joey Minucci was recording on a line pad where he kept track of visitors in their order of arrival, the names of the men who had just walked in, Jimmy Givney and Cutie LaRue. Joey was printing each name, for he could not write script or read it. Bart Merrigan spoke to the two arrivals. Merrigan, who had gone into the Army with Roscoe and Patsy McCall in 1917, was built like a bowling pin, an ex-boxer and a man of great energy whom Roscoe trusted with his life. Merrigan leaned into Roscoe's office. "Patsy called. He'll be in the Tenite lobby in 15 minutes. Givney from the 12th Ward and Cutie LaRue just came in." "Have them come back Friday," Roscoe said. "Is the war over?" "Not yet. Cutie says you'll want to see him." "How does he know?" "Cutie knows, and what Cutie don't know, he'll find out." "Send him in." Merrigan told Jimmy Givney to come back Friday, and Joey scratched a line through his name using a ruler for neatness. Merrigan turned up the volume on the desk radio he was monitoring for news of the official Japanese surrender. A large framed photo of the new president hung on the wall behind his desk. On the opposite wall hung George Washington, FDR, who was still draped in black crepe, and Alexander Fitzgibbon, the young mayor of Albany. "What can I do for you, Cutie?" Roscoe asked. "Can we close the door?" "Close it." And Cutie did, and then he sat down. George Cutie LaRue was an aspiring lawyer who had failed the bar examination 14 times in 8 states before he passed it. He did not practice, but he knew most of the political population of Albany on a first-name basis. He functioned as a legislative lobbyist, and everybody knew him by his large, heavy-lidded Oriental eyes, though he was French. He had a low forehead and combed his hair straight back. His tic was slicking back the hair over his right ear with the heel of his hand as he exhaled cigarette smoke from his mouth and inhaled it up his nose. Cutie knew your needs, and he often lobbied for you, whether you paid him or not. If he delivered, you paid him. If he didn't deliver, he'd try again next season, next session. He held no grudges, for he was ambitious. Cutie once overheard Patsy McCall saying he wanted a book on Ambrose Burnside, a Union general in the Civil War, but it was out of print. Cutie learned that a copy was sitting on a shelf in the library at West Point. He drove to West Point, stole the book, and gave it to Patsy. You didn't hear this from me, Cutie said to Roscoe. I don't even know what you look like, Roscoe said. I heard it from Scully's office this afternoon. Straight stuff, Roscoe, I kid you not. Are you talking, Cute, or are you trying to say something? They want to nail you. This is very big news, Cute. I wish you could stay longer. They have stuff they can use. Like that missing 40,000 when they subpoenaed our books. That money is not missing, Roscoe said. They're tapping your lines, reading your mail, watching your wild girlfriend, Trish Cooney. She's easy to watch. Also, she leaves the shades up. They know all your moves with women. You mean they get paid for this? You got a reputation, Roscoe. You know how they like scandal. I wish my life was that interesting, but thanks, Cute. Is that it? They're on you full time. I heard Scully himself say nailing you was as good as nailing Patsy. I appreciate this news. You know what I'm looking for, Roscoe. Yes, I do. A courtroom you can call your own. It's not asking a lot. I'm not talking Supreme Court. Small claims court, maybe, or traffic court. I'd make a hell of a judge. Roscoe considered that. The Cute judge. Cute, the judge. Judge Cutie. Cutie judgy. Jurors in his court would do cutie duty. A hell of a judge, Roscoe said. It goes without saying. Roscoe put on his blue seersucker suit coat, waved farewell to the boys, and took the elevator down and went up State Street Hill. The day was August 14, 1945. Roscoe wore a full beard going gray, but his mustache was mostly black. Trust no man, not even your brother, if his beard is one color and his mustache another. He was fat, but he looked only burly, thinking about developing an ulcer, but he seemed fit. He was burning up, but he looked cool in his seersucker. He went into the State Street entrance of the Ten Eyck Hotel and up the stairs to the lobby, which was also cool and busy with people checking in. 3 soldiers, 2 wacks, a sailor, and a girl. Rooms scarce tonight if the Japs surrendered. He crossed the marble floor of the lobby and sat where he always sat, precisely where Felix Conway, his father, had sat, the corner known then and now as the Conway Corner. He signaled silently to Whitey the bellhop to send a waiter in a gin and quinine water, his daily ritual at this hour. He looked across the lobby, trying to see his father. I'm looking for advice, he told the old man. Roscoe's condition had become so confounding that he had asked Patsy McCall and Elisha Fitzgibbon, his 2 great friends, with whom he formed the triaxial brain trust of the Albany Democratic Party, to come to the hotel and talk to him away from all other ears. Roscoe, at this moment, staring across time, finds his father sitting in this corner. It is a chilly spring afternoon in 1917. The First Great War is ongoing in Europe, and Roscoe, 27, will soon be in that war. He's clean-shaven, a lawyer whose chief client is the Fitzgibbon steel mill, and he also has an eye on politics. Felix Conway, his father, is a man of 65 with a full gray beard in 1917, the beard down to his chest, hiding his necktie. He's wearing a waistcoat, suit coat, overcoat, and cap, and he also covers himself with a blanket to fend off the deadly springtime drafts in the Ten Eyck Hotel lobby. Felix is a hotel dweller and will remain one for the rest of his days, which are not many. He had been the thrice-elected, once-ejected mayor of Albany and made a sizable fortune brewing ale and lager. He was ousted from City Hall in 1893 after a lawsuit over voting fraud, but his Democrats regained City Hall in the next election and kept it for 5 years. In those years, Felix was the party's elder statesman with an office next to the new mayor and a luncheon table at the Sadler Room in Keeler's restaurant where he held court for Democrats and influenced salesmen of all varieties. This lush period for Felix ended in 1899. In that year, the Republicans took City Hall and also found they could afford lunch at Keeler's great restaurant. But Felix could not bear the effluvia they gave off, so he went home for lunch. It took him 6 months to admit he was not suited to living full-time among his wife, 2 sons, and 3 daughters. And when he did admit it, he betook himself to the brand new Ten Eyck Hotel and told the folks, "Goodbye, dear family. I'll be home Saturday afternoon and stay till Sunday tea. We'll have a fine time going to Mass, eating the home-cooked meal. Won't it be grand?" "Yes, it will. And then I'll be done with you for a week." The Republicans of 1917 are secure in their power, and the Democrats no longer even try to win, for it is more profitable to play the loser and take Republican handouts for assuming this pose. Yet Democratic reform elements endure, and there sits Roscoe beside his father, eavesdropping as the old man holds court for a steady, life-giving flow of pals, pals, has-beens, and would-bes. Bellhop's Daily Place reserved signs on the marble tea table, the Empire armchair and sofa in the Felix Conway corner. At the moment, Felix is in his chair giving an audience to Eddie McDermott, leader of yet another reform faction that hopes to challenge Packy McCabe's useless but invulnerable Albany Democratic Party organization in the 1917 primary. Eddie stares into Felix's eye and revealing his plans to reform the party if he wins the primary and reform the city if he wins the election. He leans farther and farther forward as he speaks ever so softly to Felix, finally rolling off the sofa onto one knee to make his message not only sincere but genuflectional. And he whispers to the Solomon of Albany politics, "You do want the Democrats to make a comeback and take City Hall again, don't you, sir?" "Oh, I do," said Felix. And he truly does. "I have much to learn, Mr. Conway, but there's one thing I can learn only from you, for nobody else has an answer. And I've asked them all." "What might that be, Mr. McDermott?" "Once we take the party, how do we get the money to run it?" Felix Conway throws his arms wide, kiting his blanket toward the outer lobby, startling Roscoe. He opens both his coats, pulls off his muffler, the better to breathe, and he begins to laugh. "He wants to know how you get the money," Felix says to Roscoe. And then his laughter roars out of control, and he rises from his chair, and he shouts out, "How do you get the money? Oh, my Jesus, how do you get the money?" And then the laughter, paroxysmal now, seals Felix's throat and bloats him with its containment. He floats up from his chair, still with a smile as wide as his head, and he rises like a hot air balloon, caroming off the balustrade of the Tennessee marble stairways, and he keeps rising on up to collide with the lobby's French chandelier, where he explodes in a final thunderclap of a laugh, sending crystal shards raining down onto Eddie McDermott, the terrified reformer below. Felix declares his principles to Roscoe. How do you get the money, boy? If you run them for office and they win, you charge them a year's wages. Keep taxes low, but if you have to raise them, call it something else. The city can't do without vice, so pinch the pimps and milk the madams. Anybody that sells the flesh, tax them. Anybody wants city business, 30% back to us. Maintain the streets and sewers, but don't overdo it. Well-lit streets to discourage sin, but don't overdo it. If they play craps, poker, or blackjack, cut the game. If they play faro or roulette, cut it double. Opium is the opiate of the depraved, but if they want it, see that they get it, and tax those low-life bastards. If they keep their dance halls open 24 hours, tax them twice. If they run a gyp joint, tax them triple. If they send prisoners to our jail, charge them rent at hotel prices. Keep the cops happy and let them have a piece of the pie, a small piece. Never buy anything that you can rent forever. If you pave a street, a 3-cent brick should be worth 30 cents to the city. Pave every street with a church on it. Cultivate priests and acquire the bishop. Encourage parents to send their kids to Catholic schools. It lowers the public school budget. When in doubt, appoint another judge and pay him enough so you don't have to shake down the lawyers. Cultivate lawyers. They know how it is done and will do it. Control the district attorney and never let him go, for he controls the grand juries. Make friends with millionaires and give them what they need. Any traction company is a good traction company, and the same goes for electricity. If you build a viaduct, make the contractor your partner. Whenever you confront a monopoly, acquire it. Open an insurance company and make anybody doing city business buy a nice policy. If you don't know diddle about insurance, open a brewery and make them buy your beer. Give your friends jobs, but at a price, and make new friends every day. Let the sheriff buy anything he wants for the jail. Never stop a ward leader from stealing. It's what keeps him honest. Keep your plumbers and electricians working, and remember it takes 3 men to change a wire. Republicans are all right as long as they're on our payroll. A city job should raise a man's dignity, but not his wages. Anybody on our payroll pays us dues, 3% of the yearly salary, which is nice. But if they're on that new civil service and they won't pay and you can't fire them, transfer them to the dump. If you find people who like to vote, let them. Don't be afraid to spend money for votes on election day. It's a godsend to the poor and good for business. But make it old bills, ones and twos, and if they get suspicious otherwise. And only give them out in the river wards, never uptown. If an uptown voter won't register Democrat, raise his taxes. If he fights the raise, make him hire one of our lawyers to reduce it in court. Once it's lowered, raise it again next year. Knock on every door and find out if they're sick or pregnant or simple-minded, and vote them. If they're breathing, take them to the polls. If they won't go, threaten them. Find out who's dead and who's dying, which is as good as dead, and vote them. There's a hell of a lot of dead, and they never complain. The opposition might cry fraud, but just let them prove it after the election. People say voting the dead is immoral, but what the hell? If they were alive, they'd all be Democrats. Just because they're dead don't mean they're Republicans. So begins Roscoe's Odyssey. That was 1945. Now, this is This is something else. This is a peculiar book, but this part of it, some of it takes place in Cuba, but this part is in Albany, and the date is June the 5th, 1968. This is from a novel that is unfinished and untitled. Anybody's got a title for it, I'll be glad to listen. If you ask Daniel Quinn how he'd felt, he'd tell you, if I felt any better, I'd get a divorce. The density of his day, just beginning at 3 p.m, was already dizzying with urgencies. The day began with the tragedy of Bobby Kennedy, comatose but wide-eyed on a hotel kitchen floor. Vigils for him now unfolding across the nation, including one in Albany. Quinn's story in yesterday's paper on the silencing of a local radical priest had infuriated blacks and college students, and a protest meeting set for tonight could inflame a city already hot with racial tension. Quinn lived with his father, who could not be left alone. Quinn's wife had gone to the hospital to pick up her niece, and Ursula, the family housekeeper who doubled as the keeper of the quixotic father, had totaled her car and would do no keeping of any sort today. But Quinn could not leave the old man alone in the house. He went upstairs and found him dressed for dinner, gray Palm Beach suit, maroon paisley tie, and tying knots in one of his 200 neckties. The ties hung on 4 wooden hangers in the closet, a dozen or more of them knotted and re-knotted, one tie outstanding with 4 knots in it. Quinn moved his father away from the ties and began the daily unknotting. "How are you feeling?" Quinn asked him. "I'm several flavors of excellent. How's yourself?" "I'm tip-top, but Ursula isn't coming today. She totaled her car and broke her arm." "Was she hurt?" "She broke her arm." "Ursula?" "Yes." "How did she do that?" "She totaled her car." "Was there much damage?" "It was totaled." "Well, that doesn't sound good." "No, and it means we should get you out of the house, get a little recreation. What do you say?" "Recreation is fine if you don't get too much of it." "How about a few hours? That's not too much. Get you out in the town. What do you say we get down to the Elks Club? How's that sound? I'll drop you there when I go to the newspaper. There's people who come in and out and you don't know who the hell they are. You'll know some of them. It's neglect all the way along." "What do you mean neglect?" "Right up to snuff." "What do you mean snuff?" "The best, the griff, the spiff. The whole thing here is static." "What do you mean static?" "Static has got to be good." "All right, get your hat and we'll get down to the club." "The club?" "The Elks Club. I joined the Elks when the bishop wouldn't let us have beer in the KSC alleys. I remember you were a ringleader in the protest. Beer and bowling go together." "Yeah, you can get both of them at the club." "Which club?" "The Elks. Get your hat." Quinn called Pat Mahar, custodian of the Elks, and told him George was coming in and could he keep an eye on him for a couple of hours. "Leave a message at the paper if he needs anything, Pat. Just keep him busy. Give him a beer or two, not too many. Put him in the card room. He can still play blackjack. Or in the TV room or at the pool table. Just get him talking to friends and he'll be all right. He does what he's told most of the time. I know you're not a nursemaid, Pat, but try to keep him in the club. I'll owe you $20 for your trouble. How's that?" Even with the 20, Quinn didn't trust Pat to do any of this, but it was a start. He'd stop at the club himself when he got a few minutes. What Danny said was, "There's the club right up those steps, okay?" "Of course it's okay." "I'll meet you inside at the bar at 6 o'clock. You have your watch?" "Of course I have my watch." And George got out of the car and took 2 steps toward the club. And when Danny pulled away, George turned around to watch him go. He looked up and down the block for the club. He crossed State Street and he walked down the hill and crossed Pearl Street. Steps is what Danny said. Steps loomed, five of them, brown. Nobody outside. He pushed open the door and walked across the mottled marble. He stopped and stared at all the glass and brass. Can I help you, sir? The club. Which club might that be, sir? It's right up to snuff. This is a bank, sir. Do you have an account with us? I certainly do. Fine, let me take you to a teller. Your name? My name for what? The name on your account. George Quinn. Welcome to the New York State Bank, Mr. Quinn. I'll check your account for you. It's right up to snuff. I'm sure it is. George took his wallet from his pocket and opened it to find two $5 bills. He poked a finger into a pocket of the wallet and pulled out a check. He opened it and read his name on the check. Right over here, you can write your check right here. Here's the pen. Is there anything else I can do for you? What else is there? How much would you like to write this check for, Mr. Quinn? Well, it's got to be enough. I hope it will be. George poised the pen over the check and he thought about numbers and he wrote 200 on a blank line. He put down the pen and handed the check to the man at his elbow. You have to sign it, sir. George looked at the check and picked up the pen. He signed George and gave the check to the man. Your full name, Mr. Quinn. George wrote Quinn after George. Now fill in the amount with the numbers, said the man. 200 in numbers, 200. George wrote 200 and handed the check to the man who took it to a teller. He came back and handed the check to George. I'm sorry, Mr. Quinn, I can't cash this. This is one of our checks, but your account here was closed last year. Perhaps you have an account in the Albany Savings Bank or the National Savings or City and County Savings, Mechanics and Farmers. Any of those banks sound familiar to you? My bank is close to the club. I'm not sure which club you mean. Why the hell are you in business if you won't cash a check and don't know where the hell anything is? Shall I call Albany Savings for you? I could have someone walk you over there. Don't bother, said George, and he went out. He looked up Straight Street at the Capitol, which he had watched burn in 1911, and he wondered if they ever refinished building, if they ever finished rebuilding the damn thing. Yes, and maybe no. He had worked in the document room when Jimmy Walker was a senator and Al Smith ran the assembly. Big Bill Sulzer wasn't around yet, was he? It was Al who was the big man. Get me the World, the Sun, the Times, and the Trib, Georgie, Al would say, big smile on his kisser. Here's 50 cents. You keep the change. George crossed state and looked at Van Vechten Hall, and he thought of going to Bowman's to meet the ladies, but it's early, isn't it? He felt for his vest pocket watch. No vest, no pocket, no watch. Wrist, there it is. It's 4 o'clock, too early. Bowman's musician don't set up until 7. Hello, George, the fellow said. Hello, hello, Brits, Bits, Bildy, what the hell is his name? Where are you off to? The club, George said. You got time for a cup of coffee? All right, said George. Brad's, Bunsey, turned into the Waldorf cafeteria. George followed him in and took a ticket. Krenzy ordered the coffee. I was talking to the sheriff yesterday, Renzi said when they sat down. Renzi. He thinks you're not coming back to work. I told him George will be back when he's well. I don't think so, he said. I told him, you don't go through two cataract operations and get right back at it. George is recovering. Well, that's how it is, George said. I got these new glasses and eye drops, and he showed Renzi his eye drops. Just passing it on, just so you know, Georgie, I don't think it's good news. Just give him a call. I'll do that, George said. What'd you think about Bobby Kennedy? I voted for him. Patsy passed the word to cut him, but I voted for him. I'd vote for anybody named Kennedy. They shot him. Who shot him? Some guy, I don't know who, but they caught him right away. He's probably a communist. Kennedy's not a communist. Get the paper, Georgie. It's all in the paper. After midnight, out in L.A., he just won the primary and they shot him. Who won the primary? Bobby. They shot him because he won the primary? Probably. I voted for him. Call the sheriff and ask him when he expects you back to work, Renzi said. I'll pay for the coffee. And he took George's ticket. They don't shoot you when you win a primary, George said to Renzi's back. But Renzi kept walking and George didn't like the coffee. He went back out onto State Street and stared up at the Capitol. I saw that burn in 1911, the State Library. 2 or 3 days it burned, maybe a week. He walked toward the Capitol and looked over at the Tub, the hotel where Al Smith stayed. The sign is gone. Al doesn't have to stay there anymore. Al didn't have much money then. That's why he stayed in a place like that, but he's got it now. When Bobby Kennedy came to Albany, George was there, wasn't I? I was there for Truman when he came in the back end of a train. I was there when Adlai's train came in and he talked to the crowd down on Columbia Street. When did Bobby come here? His old man owns the Standard Building. Bootlegging, that's how the Kennedys got their money. It was Jack they shot, not Bobby. I was there when Jack came to Albany and had lunch. His father asked Patsy for an endorsement and Patsy backed him all the way. Patsy never liked FDR, but he backed Jack. That's how Jack got to be president. They didn't cut Jack. I knew some Kennedys in my day and they never took a back step for anybody. Jimmy Cagney said that to Danny. George crossed State Street at Eagle Street and he walked toward City Hall and passed it. Here comes somebody. Abe, Egg, Egg, Aggie. Nice Aggie. Hello, Georgie, the woman said. She was wearing a yellow straw hat. Hello, Aggie, George said, and he tipped his hat. Going to Bowman's, are you? Aggie stopped. Oh, I wish, she said. Bowman's. Those were the days. No, Georgie, just going over to Cody's and meet a friend. Cody's. Cody's Havana, you know it well. No Bowman's, no more. Havana, I know it. Bowman's. Aggie walked on and George watched her go. She had legs like... legs... like... I'm tying the leaves so they won't fall down and Nellie won't go away. Peg. Legs like Peg. George turned and saw the courthouse and he stopped. Can't go there. Why not? He turned back towards City Hall and he saw the Chedge coming out. Chedge Epstein and somebody. Fitz? No. Fitz Mayer? No. The mayor. They saw him coming and waited at the corner. George crossed to meet them. Hello, Chudge. Hello, Ma, George said. George, where you been? We miss you. Been in and out, up and down, George said. Damn it all, George, let's get you up to the lake. Get a few fellas together and play a little golf. You said it, Judge. Golf. Haven't played golf in quite a while, Judge. You feeling all right, George? The mayor asked. I heard they operated on you. New glasses, Mayor. New eyes. They'll improve your putting, the mayor said. Putt, putt, George said. Going over to Havana. Havana, Cuba? I love it down there, but that's a long way to go to play golf, the mayor said. And George sang, Cuba, that's where I'm going. Cuba, that's where I'll stay. Haven't heard that one in a while, the mayor said. Stop in my chambers, George, the judge said. We'll talk about you coming up for some golf. I will, Judge, I will. I'll say a prayer for you. A prayer? You think you can beat me? 2 Hail Marys, George said. That's the wrong religion, the judge said. And he and the mayor both laughed and walked up the street. Judge, Epstein, Morris, always wants me to play golf. Mayor Fitz, Fitz what? George watched the judge and the mayor walk up Washington Avenue. Going to have a beer, that's what they do after work, up to the club, Fort Fitz, the fort. Mayor Alex Fitz. George decided he wanted a beer, wanted it cold, the foam sliced off the top by the bartender and the glass with frost on it. He did not know where to go to get such a beer. Fort Orange, Fort Fitzgibbon, the club has a beer. Where is it? He walked down State Street past the Oaks Club and turned onto Lodge Street, down past the old Christian Brothers Academy. Brother who? Taught reading and writing, arithmetic, taught to the tune of the hickory stick, brother, I never liked him. Brother Bernadine was a good fellow. Knocko, they called the other one, Brother Knocko. He walked past Jack Shaughnessy's old town tavern, but it's not there. The new place is there. Don't like the looks of it. It's a dump. He walked down Beaver Street past Rudnick's, Jack's Oyster House, Apollo Billiards. That's where Billy won the candy store. We booked numbers in the back of that store, and Billy dealt poker. George crossed to the other side of Beaver and walked back the way he came and up the hill to where Beaver met Eagle. He saw the second police precinct. He saw the second police precinct. Stay out of there. Across from it, he saw a word in the window that he liked. Stanwyck's. That's Patsy. He went in and stood at the bar. People on bar stools were watching television. Bobby Kennedy is out of surgery. It's shocking. He's in critical condition. The nation is stunned. The colored fellow behind the bar looked at George. What can I get you? What's in the window? What do you want? The sign in the window. You want the sign? I want that. And he pointed to the neon window sign with Stanwyck's spelled backward. You want a Stanwyck's beer, is that it? Yes. What's the name of this place? Cody's, the man said. This isn't the club, I know that. It's Cody's Havana Club, if that's what you mean. Cody's Havana Club, George said. I've been here before. I'll get your beer, the man said. George took a swallow of the beer and he loved it. He looked at it and watched it sweat. He rubbed the sweat and then lifted the glass and he sipped it. He loved the taste, the coldness on the tongue, the coldness in his throat. I should drink more beer. He tipped up the glass and finished it. He licked the foam off his lips. The bartender looked at him. Do it again? He asked George. Do what again? Have another beer. Good idea. I'll have another beer and do it again. The barman drew another beer. Only costs you a dollar, he said. What does? The beer. A dollar? That's way too much. Beer costs a nickel. Some places they charge a dime. A glass of Bordeaux wine costs 10 cents in Paris. That's before I was born, the bartender said. You want a beer today? It's 50 cents a glass, and you had two glasses, $1. George took out his wallet and fished for one of his $5 bills. He gave it to the man and stared at him. Is your name Dick? George asked. No. You look like a friend of mine. I haven't seen him in a while. You know Van Wart Street? I do, the bartender said. Dick, that was his name, Dick Hawkins. Do you know him? Never heard of him. Nigger Dick Hawkins, George said. He could go in and out of anybody's house on Van Wart Street, just like a white man. Nigger Dick on Van Wart Street. Imagine that, the bartender said. Wonderful fella, George said. He'd do anything for me. They'd come around and tell me this and that, and they could say to them, you leave this kid alone. He's a friend of mine. And they'd never touch me. Looked a lot like you. Is your name Dick by any chance? No, my name is George, Nigger George. I live on Van Wart Street. You ever heard of me? No, can't say that I have, and I live on Van Wart Street. Nigger Dick, I know, wonderful fellow, looks just like you. He'd do anything for me. You know what I'll do for you, the bartender said? No, I'll get your change. You'll finish your beer, and then I'll kiss your ass the fuck out of this bar. Hey, what are you saying? I'm saying I don't want your business, motherfucker. Are you crazy? You can't use that language in public. There's women in here. Everybody in the bar was looking at George. A man wearing his shirt outside his pants, two women in straw hats. George tipped his hat to the women who were sitting at the bar separated by one stool. That looks like Aggie. George saw them all staring as if they expected something from him. So he picked up his beer and he raised a toast. I care not for riches or wealth of the best. I care not for finery grand. Just give me a lass who owns a good name and give me a willing hand. He smiled and took a mouthful of his second beer. The woman in the yellow straw hat raised her glass to George and took a sip. He's all right, Roy, she said to the bartender. Sure he is, Roy said. No, she said, I know him from the court. He handles the grand juries. George broke into song. Goodbye, gang, I'm through. Oh, pals, I can't forget. I say goodbye to you without the least regret. I know that song, the woman said, and she sang along with George. I'm through with old flirtations. There'll be no more fascinations. There's one to whom I'm true. Goodbye, boys, goodbye, girls. Goodbye, gang, I'm through. Behind the bar, Roy turned up the volume on the news show. The woman came over to George at the bar. George Quinn, she said, you're still a rascal. George Josephus Jeremiah Randolph Franklin Aloysius Quinn, he said. A pleasure to see you, my dear. Will you kiss me now or will you wait? You're a scream. The last time we were in a bar together was at Farnham's. Do you remember? Farnham's is a wonderful place, right up to snuff. Oh, I know. I love the atmosphere, the wonderful dark wood. Oh, the atmosphere is wonderful, the wood. You mustn't mind the bartender, George. He's a sensitive boy. He doesn't like that word you used. What word? Nigger, she whispered it. Nigger Dick, I knew him well. But you shouldn't say his name like that anymore. Just call him Dick and don't say nigger. That's his name, Nigger Dick. He was part of the Sheridan Avenue gang. I knew every one of them. There was only one Nigger Dick. And just don't say it anymore, you understand? Don't say it or he'll throw you out. Roy can get very excited. Roy, who's Roy? The bartender, his name was, he said his name was George, but it isn't. Right, he's not George, I'm George. You certainly are, George Quinn. That's me. You're a gentleman, George Quinn. Will you be going dancing at Bowman's this evening, he asked. You're still thinking about Bowman's. It's right up to snuff. King Jazz's orchestra, you can't beat it. I don't recall your name. Agnes. Agnes Sexton, George. Aggie. You know me 100 years. George took off his hat and held it out to her. It's venerable to know you so long, Agnes, he said. You are such a gentleman, she said. I would be privileged to buy you a drink, Agnes. We could sit at that table over there. I'm on my way to the club, but I have to cash a check. The clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to tell just where the hands will stop. Well, that certainly is true, George, and it's a very poetic thing to say. I'd be glad to have a drink with you. George placed his hat over his heart, and he asked her, will you kiss me now, or will you wait? And Aggie kissed him on the cheek. I would answer some questions if anybody had any.
Question about Albany and politics. The last gubernatorial election, my buddy Pat O'Connell said I should vote for McCourt to keep the Green Party on the line. And I did, but I didn't hear any results from that. I wonder if you might have know anything, how that came out.
I haven't a clue. I only watch the Democratic Party. And they won, as you may remember. They usually do that. The Green Party, I think, did pretty well. I think, wasn't Spitzer endorsed by the Greens? I think a couple of, serious Democrats were endorsed by the Greens. I think they're a viable party, and in a lot of ways, they supported David Soares, who's the district attorney of Albany County now, a black man. It's the first breakthrough for, he won in a primary. He beat the old line politicians. He was a new voice, and I think the Greens, and there was a Citizens Party out of New York, I think. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it had some serious money, and they supported him, and he really defeated the old line Democrats. It was quite a major transformation up in Albany. Not unlike the transformation when Pataki ran the last time, and the mayor of Albany was a Democrat, Jerry Jennings, in his second term at that time. He supported Pataki, a Republican. It was unheard of. They had to send up special tools to the cemetery to stop the ward leaders up there from spinning in their graves. Anybody have a, yes, sir.
You reference a lot of downtown Albany in all your books. Does it break your heart when things change, like buildings go down? Albany's still an old city, and it still has a lot of the old, infrastructure there. But when things change, does it kind of like break your heart to see things move around?
Well, sometimes it does. I think that, I've gone to bat for a few causes in the past when they were tearing down the old Cottrell and Leonard store down on Broadway, between Broadway and James Street. But they tore it down for a good cause, for a parking lot, for a bank. it was a fire trap, and it wasn't going to be rejuvenated or anything like that. It might have been salvaged as, I don't know why, but it was prime turf, and they've since built buildings around it. That's now in the real comeback stage. Albany's downtown, which has had a lot of old collapsing buildings disappear, and some of them stay up forever. Somebody told me yesterday there were now 900 empty houses in the city, and that they can't and won't. Too expensive to tear them down, but they're a fire hazard, rats, roaches, thieves, crack houses, all sorts of stuff. And it pains me to see the certain valuable things like the library that I grew up with. My first library card was on Clinton Square. It's called the Prime Library. It was named for an old Dutchman who was chancellor of the university and the first one of the founders of this New York Central Railroad. And I had spent a lot of time with his writing and reading about his daughter, High Bertie. And the place was named for him. It was a gorgeous little library with a Dutch step architecture. But Rockefeller was putting up 787, and they knocked it down for an access road and disappeared. I talked to one of the contractors, and he said if I worked a little harder, I might have been able to save it. But the mayor said he wanted to save it, but he couldn't afford to. He didn't have the money to save it. They would have had to move it. And it was about a four-story building or three-story building. And beautiful. Sad to see that go. Anyway, Albany's in a spiral into newness, and it's at the same time it's having a lot of trouble in the inner cities. Lamar.
Tell us if we can get this last book in our hands soon.
I wish I knew. It's moving along. This is the sort of the opening section of the 1968 segment, and it begins the day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on June the 5th, and it'll go till somewhere in the early morning of the following day, I think. And that's, it'll probably be all in one day, that part. The Cuba section takes place in prior to the revolution, the triumph of the revolution, a couple of years earlier, in the anti-Batista years, and Castro is up in the hills, but just fairly recently. And I'm working on that as well.
Will Albany families or somebody be down there in Cuba on this?
Daniel Quinn, the guy who's George Quinn, his son, who takes the father down to the Elks Club. He's in Havana in 1957, and so is his wife, who's a Cuban. And there's a lot of Cuban. There's a great many Albany Cuban connections. It's the old Albany-Cuban connection. Didn't you ever hear about it?
No, but it's going to be known now.
like to live in the same town?
Yeah, what it's like to write in the same town where you live.
Oh, that's a good one. When I started to write about Albany, I was in Puerto Rico. I was running a newspaper. I was a managing editor, and I was working part-time and weekends and things like that. I was working very, very long days at the newspaper, 6 days a week. But I was working toward the novel, and I realized how little I knew about Albany. And I swore when I went back to Albany, I would try to do some research and expand my knowledge of it. And circumstances deemed that I leave before I really thought I was going to. I had a sickness in the family, and I came home and thought I would be here a short while, and then I stayed. And I went back to work part-time for my old newspaper. And they always wanted me to come back under any circumstances, so I went back a half-time, and I went in to do feature pieces, write about anything I wanted to write about, really. And the first assignment I got was to do a history of the city's neighborhoods. And it was tailor-made for me. And the city editor didn't know that, and I didn't really know it. I undertook it, and I stayed on it for 4 months, and I wrote a 26-article series, which 20 years later turned into Old Albany, much expanded. But I no longer had the problem of not knowing what I was writing about, because I really now understood the city, and I had all these resources at my command, and I many books. The history of Albany is terrific, and I just loved that whole experience, and it reinforced my idea of writing about Albany at great length. I didn't intend to do that before. I thought I would write one book and that'd be it and go on to something else. I never thought of this any these books of being connected. But after that experience, I began to think about Albany as an epic source of story, because it's the oldest chartered city in the United States, and under the English, and the Dutch colonization is very wonderful stuff going on back then. It was really terrific. I mean, 4 centuries. And so I'm not going to run out of material. I may run out of imagination, but not material. And I love being in the center of it. It feeds me one way or the other. I mean, people still tell me stories about Legs Diamond. I finished that book in 1974. But I put him in Roscoe again because I couldn't not use some of the stories. Yes.
What writers do you read, and are they writers that write out of a sense of place?
I just bought Tree of Smoke by one of my predecessors at this series, Dennis Johnson. I think he's a terrific writer. I've only read a few of his stories. I mean, I read Jesus' Son, and I read some other stories, and I read The Confessions of a Hanged Man. I can never remember that title, but I'm really liking this new book. I've just started it. I can't really talk about it, but I think I would read everything that he does. I feel the same way about Cormac McCarthy. I just reviewed his last one, The Road. I'm sure I helped him sell some copies, just what he needs, which he became an Oprah book, and making a movie of it, anyway, he's a very, very fascinating writer, and I don't know, who else do I read? I read Alison Lurie and Edward Hauer. I read Lamar Herron. I read Philip Roth. I'm trying to read the new one, Exit Ghost, which is very interesting. It's about getting old, and I sympathize with the protagonist. I don't know. I go on and on. I can. I can't remember. I always forget 20 of my dearest and greatest friends. Anyway, somebody else. Yes, sir.
How do you write? What's your daily activity, or how do you structure your writing?
I get up in the morning and I have a breakfast, and finish breakfast about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and then I go to work first thing, you know. But it's true, mostly, you know, sometimes I get up at 8 o'clock and go to work, but usually I don't go to bed till 2 o'clock in the morning. 1:20, it seems, it's always 1:20 when I turn the light on. And then I work in the morning as much as I can. I have a very active social life, a family that invades my consciousness and my presence in my office constantly. Twin girls, 1-year-old, 4-year-old, granddaughter, 2 daughters, 4 grown grandchildren in their teens, and a wife. People coming to fix things, and I still try to write, but you know, sometimes I achieve it, sometimes I don't. But I'm moving along, you know. This book with George Quinn is moving along okay. I'm feeling pretty good about that. I'm glad to get back to work and re-encounter George. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone.
Just to follow up, if you're not on our email list and don't know when our readings are, there's a sign-up sheet on the book table. And all of you are invited to go upstairs to the second floor to the English Lounge for a reception. Thank you.